They told us you were all right, but after the brief scare of your birth, they wanted to monitor you, assist you with your breathing. I would wait until your mother was asleep to walk the halls until I found myself at your floor, just one above hers, and look at you and the other tiny babies in their clear cribs. The humming of the machinery, the quiet of the night. Some of the lights had been dimmed because it would be 3 or 4 in the morning. I would stand in the same spot, at the center of the glass window, my hand closed into a fist and stuffed into my jacket pocket, focused on the small baby that was you. Your hand rested by your face, your fingers curled, the way you would fall asleep for years to come, but I did not know that then. I did not know anything. My feet would ache, and I would shift my weight from one foot to the other. For hours I stood, praying mainly. That desperate kind of praying, the kind I have little experience with, the kind that cannot wait until I kneel in sijda, so instead I speak directly to God. Anything if he makes it through the next few days. Anything for this. We had named you Amar. As I stood at the glass window, I thought of your name until it became familiar to me. If I was not speaking to God, I was speaking to you. You'll be okay, Amar. We'll take you home soon. Layla had wanted to name each of our children after holy figures. After all, she said, why wouldn't we want to give our children the best of names? But I had this funny idea that I thought then was noble. That perhaps others could name their children after the prophet and his family, but how could I, not knowing what my children would go on to do, knowing they might sin in some way, and in that way they would bring down not only themselves, but a name so holy with them. Now I wonder if that was a mistake. That had I named you Ali or Muhammad or Hussein, maybe it would have been a constant and inescapable reminder for you to hold yourself to a standard they inspired. Those nights there was a nurse on duty named Dawn. I remember how her name reminded me of a poem I encountered in college, years after the passing of my parents, that had been soothing to me. Dawn had short red hair and little freckles on her face. She had light eyelashes and was kind to me. She told me which floors had vending machines and where I could get a bagel when morning came. She made small talk, which I had never been good at, but perhaps because of the odd hour of night and the strange state of mind I was in, I was all right at talking with her. That one is mine, I said, touching my finger to the glass. Beautiful, she said. You're first? She had a soft, calming voice, made softer by the fact that we were whispering to one another. First son. I have 2 girls, too. You're a lucky man, she said. And your son will be just fine. There was certainty in her voice, as though it came from somewhere else, as though she had been placed there just to tell me that. I was so terrified. I could have cried when she said it. And what does an MRI reveal? I turn my head to ask the nurse who is wheeling me down the corridor. I know in a general sense, but I want to hear what he has to say. I want to know if there is anything Hadia has kept from me. I have been hesitant to ask her questions. An image of your brain. Do you know what the doctor is looking for? I twist the loose plastic bracelet around my wrist and wait for his answer, holding my breath. No, sir, I have not spoken with the doctor, but the MRI will be painless. I am wheeled into the bright, quiet room. I am given earplugs. Every wall here is too white. The dome and the bed in the center, which must be the machine, and the technician telling me to lie on my back, telling me not to move. Then I am alone. The technician is on the other side of the wall. Somewhere in this building is Hadia, comforting a patient or looking over her notes before walking in to see another one. I realize how lucky I am, that if there is any hint of an issue, she can make sense of the tests, easily ask to order others, think of what to do. The bed begins to move slowly back into the tunnel. I close my eyes. The noises are loud and erratic, even with the earplugs. I am very still. When I open my eyes again, a light is moving across the curvature of the tunnel, and I think of how unnatural it is to keep ourselves alive in this way. I want to live, I realize. But the thought that surprises me is the darker one that comes after, that I also want for there to be something wrong, and for it to be serious. And immediately I wonder if God will punish me for the thought. Then the beeping is done, and I wait for a cue to move. Before you were born, I thought I knew how to be a father. Hadia was 4 when we brought you home. Hudda, only 3. Making them smile was easy. Keeping them smiling, simple. Layla would tell me that they would watch for the darkening of the sky, listen for the turning of the key and creak of the door, ready to abandon their coloring books or unfinished bowls of dinner to rush to me, each one holding on to a leg that I had to drag to move. And when I managed to, they laughed and tightened their grip. If they misbehaved, I only had to glare at them. In some instances, a voice raised, a flick to their lip, a twisting of their ear. So little it took to make them obey. Once they were done crying after a punishment, they would not become cold, but would wonder how to make it better. Hadia would tilt her head and speak in a voice both mature and innocent, waiting for a sign of my approval, of forgiveness. Fudda would rub her head against my arm like a cat until I hugged her. And here was another thing I took for granted in those years. Their ability to continue on as though nothing had happened. You were something else. You did not let your mother sleep. Did you know that? Hadia and Hudda had also cried, had also woken at odd hours. But your screams came from somewhere else, not motivated by hunger or discomfort, I would think when I tried to comfort you. And that thought unsettled me. I was worn out by your screaming, or maybe it was my inability to console you. And so I would hand you to Layla. She would take you from our bedroom so I could sleep, speak to you in Urdu, using a name she had begun calling you. What is it, Ami? What's happened? Motherhood had been becoming on Layla. She was so young when Hadia was born. She devoted her time and attention to her daughters as if it were her choice, keeping something of herself for herself, inhabiting the role with strength and sweetness, ease and command. Hadia and Hudda came to her when they needed her, busied themselves alone, all with each other when they did not. But with you, motherhood became a more consuming endeavor. As you grew, she became prone to anxiety and stress. While you slept, she examined your bruises. Look, she would say, pointing to a purple mark on your thigh. How do you think he managed to hurt himself here? I wonder now if she had intuited what I could not, or what I refused to, that it would not be easy for us when it came to you. Though you did not know it, you had divided the attention of our home. If Hadia and Huda were on one side, you were on the other. And Layla was turned to you. Your sisters were resilient. Little denials and little losses and lectures did not alter the course of their day. You were stubborn with your sadness. You would enter it and not leave. And instead of softening, I hardened in my approach. Most mornings, I was in charge of dropping Hadia and Huda off at school. Before I left, I would look back at you, kicking your legs as you lay on your stomach to color, and wonder what you and your mother did all day with the rest of us gone. My daughters always wanted more from me. One more story, Baba. Two more minutes, Baba. They tiptoed and turned their cheeks toward me so I could kiss them. At the park, they asked me to push them on swings or climbed on me like monkeys. You did not ask for any of these things. I did not know if it was indifference or a desire for independence that kept you from me. But every few months, before you turned 5, you and I had a day alone together. I would come home to find your mother had taken it upon herself to cut your hair again. The sight of you with a jagged and uneven haircut never failed to irritate me. Maybe it felt like a game to you both. Your mother lifting you up to the bathroom countertop, wrapping a towel around your neck to catch dark tufts of your hair. Layla, I would tell her, trying to control my annoyance, why do you always do this? Make him look silly like this. The following Sunday, we would go together to get a haircut. When I watch Hadia and Tariq interact with their kids now, it seems strange to me that those were some of the only times we were alone. Hadia and Tariq are such different parents. In some instances, they upset me greatly, letting Abbas go off into the neighborhood alone without knowing exactly who he will be playing with. But in other ways, they are getting right what we did not even think to consider. They take their children on dates. Sometimes Hadia takes Abbas and Tariq takes Tahira, and sometimes the other way around. We are the way we are as a family. It's special for them and nice for us to see what we can be, one-on-one, Hadia explained once when I asked her why. You always went with your mother everywhere. When she stood up to go to the grocery store, you rose to accompany her. If she was not present, you were Hadia's shadow. If I stood to leave for an errand, if Hadia or Huda did not offer to come, I went alone. I worried about you growing up in a house full of women, looking only to them for an example. I feared you would not know how to be, how to behave, that I was doing nothing to teach you. Come, I'd say. Let's go fix your hair. The glance you gave your mother was not lost on me. The only thing worse was how she would nod to you in return, as if giving you permission to go, to trust me. I would lift you into my arms, which I never really got used to. Yes, I held my children when they were babies, but often when Layla's arms were occupied or if she needed a break, and I would try to entertain you all the simplest way I knew how. I would take you outside and point to the sky. Look, stars. Look, moon. But when I held you and we made our way to the car, I remember you would put your head on my shoulder as if you were tired. I remember you would scratch the thread of my top button until we reached the car. And I remember wondering if my own father had ever held me. And now, when I think back, I do not think he ever did. I risked buckling you into the front seat. I wanted you to think something special was happening. I wanted you to look out the window and feel yourself at the edge of the world as you approached it. I drove slowly. I looked out for cop cars. I looked over at you from time to time, your back straight, your hand gripping the tan seatbelt, your face turned to look out the window. I tried to make conversation. Talking to anyone has always been a bit strange for me. Talking to a child, no less unnerving. I spoke to you as though you were already an adult. How was your week? I would ask. We would glide down the street that was my favorite in our city. One long line that curved up and down with the hills, thick trees lining both sides. The only street that ever made me feel like it was fall in California, because driving by rows and rows of trees made it apparent that the leaves were changing color. You were short with your replies. Shy, as though I were a stranger. Were we lost, even then, at that early age? You, 3.5 years old and so quiet? I tried to not feel disappointed. I searched for things to speak of. That is a post office, I said, when we passed one. Do you know what happens at a post office? You shrugged a single shoulder, as though I bored you. At the barber shop, I would unlock the car door and you would hop out. Our barber's name was Jim. He was a nice man who recognized us, his loyal customers, and he would take one look at your mess of a haircut and say, "Again?" He and I would laugh about it. It was like a joke between us. I would lift you into the raised seat, smaller than the rest, and Jim would wrap a black cloth around your neck that swallowed your whole body. When he approached you with scissors, you would look back at me in the mirror. I never stepped away. I wondered if Jim thought that you and I were close, that I did things with you often, or if he could sense how wary we were of one another. We would walk out holding a strawberry or watermelon lollipop. In the entire bowl, those were the flavors you gravitated to, and I took one and tucked it in my pocket to give to you later. I wanted our day to last longer, and so I would ask if you wanted a scoop when we passed the ice cream shop. And your eyes would light up like Hadia's and Huda's did when I agreed to read a story to them. The door made a moo sound when we entered, and I lifted you up to the counter and you pressed your face against the glass to look at all the flavors, your breath leaving circles of fog. I stopped myself from reminding you that the glass had germs. "Not today," I told myself. Once, when I was a boy, my father had taken me to the ice cream parlor in Hyderabad. No one there offered samples like they did here. When you pointed to flavor after flavor and the girl behind the counter passed you little purple spoons with a bit of the ice cream. She told me how cute you were, smiling widely, which often happened when we went anywhere with you. Sometimes, even now, I wonder if you realized that the world loved you, softened at your presence. While I waited for you, I asked the girl for a scoop of pistachio and almond, the flavor that most reminded me of the ice cream from home. Then you would ask for the same. This happened every time. You sampled at least 4 flavors and then got mine, though you had not tried it. Is it silly that I felt proud that you copied me in that way? She gave you your cone and I got my cup. And I tipped her generously, partly because of how kind she was to you. "Shall we eat here?" I asked. And you would have relaxed with me by then. When you were excited, your legs swung because they did not reach the floor, and you were talkative and moved about in your seat, making wild gestures with your hands. You asked me questions, and I did my best to answer them. Why does forever rhyme with never? You asked me once. Another time, you asked, what's a tsunami? When I answered, you asked, why don't we ever go to the beach? And then, without missing a beat, as though it were the logical next question, why do squirrels run when I go near them? And I knew when you stopped asking me questions and turned to look out the window that our time had reached its final movement and you wanted to go home to your mother. I gathered our trash and threw it away. I wet a napkin and wiped your mouth, your fingers, and rubbed roughly the stain on your shirt so Hadia and Huda wouldn't see it and be hurt. When Hadia appears again, she is not alone. The doctor with her is very tall, especially when standing next to Hadia, his skin dark and eyes very bright, made brighter when he smiles, and even before he has extended his hand to shake mine, I trust him. My hand, when I lift it, feels weak, something that has been happening with alarming frequency and something I've kept from Hadia. His name is Dr. Edwards, he says. He is a neurosurgeon and a good friend of Hadia's. When Hadia was very young, I would remind her seriously that she had no male friends, just colleagues and acquaintances. But as she grew older, my reminder became a joke at first for her, and then, after much teasing from her, for both of us. When I glance at her seated at the edge of my bed, she is smiling mischievously, as if she has read my mind. Nothing about Dr. Edwards's demeanor suggests that something is wrong, and so I sit back against the raised bed, fold my hands in my lap. Everything is okay, Baba. Do not begin to worry, she says in Urdu, and she nods at Dr. Edwards. Dr. Edwards explains what they found in the MRI. In my brain? I ask when I hear him say tumor. Most likely benign, he responds, a meningioma in the tissue between the skull and the brain, but it has grown enough to begin to impact the brain. Mine. My mouth is dry. I look at the bracelet on my wrist and the tiny numbers that mark me as a patient, and my name that marks me as a person, and the blue veins beneath my skin, saying I am alive. He tells me that, judging by its location and size, it could be removed with little effort and then taken for a biopsy. Hadia touches my leg and says that means it's no problem, Baba. Saying it in Urdu, as if I do not speak English, as if I do not know what benign or little effort means. I search my daughter's face. She is eerily calm. I am a lucky man. And maybe when I had opened my eyes to the light moving across the dome, it was misfortune I had wished for. Something grave enough to give you a reason to return. We will have to have a surgery to remove it, Baba. It's beginning to affect you in a way we cannot ignore. Hence the headaches. Dr. Edwards has been very kind. He scheduled you in for the end of the week. Dr. Edwards asks me if I have any questions. I say I do not. I say thank you. I say I am glad Hadia has a good friend. And at this, I glance at my daughter, who has been calm, who has been using her doctor voice, who now looks quickly away from me and out the hospital window. On the bedside table beside me, two flower arrangements, one extravagant store-bought bouquet sent by my old co-workers, and one made for me by Layla. Her bouquet has her touch. I can spot any bouquet Layla arranges in an instant. The flowers were plucked from Hadia's garden. A giant plant leaf is fanned out in the back, framing them. Layla could have been an artist, I think now, as she lifts the page of her prayer book and continues moving her finger across the next page. It has been a recent pursuit of hers, growing and arranging flowers, and now every room in our home is adorned. And if there is a celebratory event for a family friend, we go with a bouquet. When you were very young, maybe 4, she came home with a packet of tomatoes and said she would try to plant them. Soon it became tomatoes and garlic. Then she read books that said do not plant the same vegetable in the same soil twice. And it might have been the challenging and particular methods that interested her. So she got a notebook where she drew our backyard and drew in squares to plan what would go where and in what season. On wooden popsicle sticks, she wrote what she planted and then pushed them into the dirt. And this was her favorite part, I think, when I came home to find her meticulously writing. Mint, green pepper, eggplant, cauliflower, basil. The year after Hadia's wedding, she did not walk into the garden to tend to anything at all. Hadia had moved to Chicago with Tariq. She was so busy with her work and getting accustomed to her new life and soon her pregnancy that she hardly visited us. Huda worked as a 4th grade teacher at a school hours away. Her evenings were often spent preparing for the next day. They called us with their stories. Hadia's first time assisting with delivering a baby, Huda winning over a particularly difficult student. He was so proud of them both. But once the phone clicked to end their call, we were so very alone. Each of you had left us in your own way. I predicted Layla would turn even more to gardening to pass the time. But instead, she made tea and sat at the kitchen table with the mug before her looking out at the backyard. Her hands wrapped around the mug for warmth, the steam rising. I would walk away, and not long after would hear the splash of the entire mug in the sink. Then, one day, about 3 years ago, I came home to see little white packets I recognized to be seeds on the kitchen table in rows. I was relieved. I always feared she had been punishing herself. But this time, it was just flowers. And a small stack of books in the corner. Flowers of California, plants of the West. She did not explain, and I did not ask. She spent months studying which flower to plant when. The first spring they bloomed was incredible. Our garden so vibrant and alive. At first, her bouquets were messy, the stems drooping against the glass. But soon, something clicked. She deliberately chose colors that complemented each other, stuck a feather in if she found a feather. I was amazed that even a jagged twig could be placed beautifully if Layla was the one to place it. When Hadia first applied to college, I could not imagine allowing her to move away. We wanted her to get engaged. We wanted her to be settled and safe, with someone who would prioritize caring for her and providing for her, as I had for my family. But when she rushed inside to tell us about the program she had been accepted into, I felt all my discomfort and fear rise up. It was not the path for her I had anticipated, and not the path I preferred. But how could I be the one to stand in her way? My daughter intended on navigating the world respectably, accomplishing something good with her intelligence, her will. The night that we found out, Layla had to be convinced. She was not worried for Hadia's safety, as I was, but rather that Hadia had disregarded our wishes for her life, and from what we could see, was doing well despite it. If she stays home, if she accepts any of these perfectly good proposals, I will know how to guide her, Layla said to me as we lay wide awake in bed, unable to fall asleep. If she begins her own way, I won't know how. And I did not know how to answer her. I searched for a way to deal with my own discomfort quietly. The day I dropped her off at her dorm, she slept the entire car ride, and I drove in the dark, watching the sky slowly lighten. I stopped for coffee, something I never drink, and each hour I drove, I thought, this is 1 hour I will have to drive back without her. This is 1 more hour that will separate me from my daughter. I kept looking over at her. She was wearing my father's watch and a blue button-up. I want to be professional, she had explained to me the night before, excited when deciding what to wear. As I drove, my fears multiplied. Whether she could handle her studies, whether she would take on too many classes at once, whether she would have friends. Oddly, I worried equally that she would not, and that she would. Whether she would know what to do when she encountered someone who pressured her to sin. But it was not until my own fears were echoed in comments from my friends that I found myself facing them and finding comfort. People would question me, "How did you let your daughter move so far? Too much independence is not good for a woman." To protect her from their judgment, I would defend her. And only after I defended her aloud again and again did I realize that I believed what I told them. Hadia will be fine. My daughter is brave and capable. She will know what to do. I trust her. Now both my daughters work. And it is not so much that I have relented and accepted this, but that these are the very things that have become a great source of pride for me. They have shown me what to value, that I did not know before them to value. When Huda calls me and says she might not be able to come visit because she is working, I am proud that she is doing something with her life that gives to others, that she teaches children, and from the stories we hear, is very good at it. Or that Hadia is regarded no differently at what she does than Tariq. And what does she do but care for human lives? She holds an intimate knowledge of what is unseen to the rest of us, what it might mean when I struggle to find balance, what it might mean if I get sharp headaches. And after asking a few questions and running tests, she can eliminate what it is not, and like a hawk, swoop down to claim what it is. Had they married the men we wanted for them years ago, we would have been happy. But if, God forbid, their husbands had been unable to provide, or if destiny had dealt a difficult card and their marriages had fallen apart, I would have sat here today, days before my surgery, and I would not be at peace. If I do go, I know that my daughters will be fine, as they are not only cared for, but also completely capable of caring for themselves, providing for themselves, and also for Layla, and also for my grandchildren. 2. There is an official knock, and I look up, thinking it might be Dr. Edwards coming to check in the night before the surgery. But it is Huda, my Huda, smiling at me gently and sort of sadly. I did not know I wanted so badly to see her until she was there, unflinching at the sight of me in a hospital gown, wires taped to my arm in a way that even Leila does not muster for my sake, and even Hadia breaks from, despite this being her profession. These are the moments when Huda's presence is most appreciated. I tell her she did not have to come, that everyone has made this into a bigger fuss than it need be. Dr. Edwards himself said that the surgery will be fairly simple. It is only Hadia who insists there are other factors complicating my health, and only Hadia anyone listens to anymore. You were never one for the proper way. And so when Hadia says I must stay here, must change my diet, and Leila agrees, and even my grandson says, please, Nana, eat what they tell you to, I think of you, and how you might have had it in you to side with me, if only because it meant disagreeing with the rest of them.
Of course I came,
she says, as she takes a seat on the chair beside me. Soon Hadia appears, and Leila too. Tahira rushes forward and climbs into Huda's lap. All the women of my life. Tariq is at soccer practice with Abbas, Hadia explains, and Huda tells me that Javed had to stay in Arizona, but sends his regards. I hated the clamoring of people before. Now, it is silence that unsettles me. Hadia holds on to Huda's shoulders and leans into her and says to me,
happy with your surprise?
I am happy, I say.
I am not afraid.
For 4 days I have known the surgery was approaching and I have prepared for it. Tahira leans back against Huda's chest. Huda runs her hand through her hair. I am amazed at the trust between them. Tahira sees Huda only a few days each year, and yet she knows somehow that this is her mother's sister. And she gives love to her that she keeps from others we see regularly. Huda is a wonderful aunt, perhaps extraordinary, the limitless space she gives them in her heart because she has no children of her own, though we've prayed every time we pray for anything at all. How long is your stay? I ask.
Just until Sunday.
Class is okay without you? She nods. Tahira lights up, remembering their game, and looks up at Huda.
Amijan, can you give me assignment?
She asks. This is how they play. Huda does anything Tahira asks. The same could be said for any of us. We become teachers for her, or puppy dogs, or patients. Tahira, the doctor, asking on a scale of 1 to 10, how much does it hurt? Behind them, I catch a look in Leila's eyes, and I know she is wishing for more moments like this one, all of us together. I have not voiced to her, or even fully to myself, my recent and recurring wish, that all of us together again includes you. When you were almost 4, your mother became pregnant. Despite how much you begged for a younger brother, your mother and I had not intended on having any more children. The night you were born returned often in my nightmares. If the dream had been particularly vivid, or if we had fought badly the day before, I would not be able to help myself from stepping into your bedroom, taking a seat on the floor, placing a finger in front of your open mouth until your warm breath touched my skin. Having feared the worst, I would naturally fear for Hadia and Huda too, and check on each of them, sleeping, breathing. I was nervous when we first learned Leila was pregnant. Her pregnancy with you had been difficult. My job required me to be away for days at a time. I would come home not knowing how sick she had been. Every time she lifted the Quran above my head for me to walk out beneath, I would look back at her, fresh-faced and chubby when carrying you, in a way that she hadn't been with the girls, and I would wonder if I was shirking my duties, prioritizing work over caring for her. I feared that though she never said as much, she resented how I left week after week. But I worked for her, I told myself. I worked for Hadia and Huda. I worked for you, even before I knew you. This is good news, Leila said the night we found out. Why do you look pareshan? I listened to her. We were lucky. Soon, we could not imagine anything else. You three were too young to inform right away, and we decided to guard the news in our hearts for a while. When my forehead touched the cool surface of the Sajdagah, I had a new prayer on my list. For the child's birth to come and pass without complication, and for it to be a healthy boy. Leila wore loose-fitted shalwar kameez around the house so the girls would not notice, and it became a pleasant secret between us as we waited for the right moment to tell them. Only you had become more tender toward her. You stopped fussing with her at dinner time. You would climb into her lap and rest your head against her.
He knows,
Leila whispered one night when you insisted on falling asleep in our bed. She moved your hair around your forehead the way she loved to. How can he? I had said, though I believed her and was unnerved by my belief. This strange feeling I had sometimes that you had access to a kind of perception or intuition that we did not.
I hope it's a boy,
Leila confessed later, when we were in the waiting room just before one of her appointments. For our first three children, we had decided to let the gender be a surprise. But for our fourth, we were eager to find out. That is also my hope, I replied. I wanted to have a second chance at being a father to a son. It was a terrible thought. I knew it as I allowed it to enter my mind and dwell there. I grabbed a magazine from the table and flipped through the glossy pages.
Wouldn't it be wonderful for Amar to have a brother? She said.
When I did not reply, she continued.
He would make a great older brother. It would be good for him. Hadia and Huda have each other. He is always so lonely, na? Now he will have someone to grow up playing with as well.
I told her I was going to the restroom. Instead, I walked back and forth across the bridge of the hospital that connected two wings, constructed like a tunnel of glass over the parking lot. I wondered how your mother could think the way she did, how everything in her naturally considered you, wanting to bear a child for your sake. Even in this, having you in mind. She sat there in the waiting room and wished for a boy to give you a brother. I paced the tunnel, knowing I had wished for a boy to give me a son. And it was going to be a boy. The doctor confirmed our hopes. Your mother took hold of my hand and leaned into me as we walked out. That day, beneath the pale blue sky, I let myself hold tightly onto her hand and marveled at how delicate and small it felt in mine. Eid was approaching, and we decided we would tell you all then. We would give you the gift of art sets and new outfits, and then make it an exciting reveal. Knowing I had a son coming made it easier to deal with my disappointments about us. Leila was never one to discipline you, so any time you misbehaved, it fell on me to drag you by the arm to your room for your time out. I told myself I was going to have another chance. I even hoped that another son would ease the pressure between us. I began to imagine him. He would not be prone to outbursts. He would not be angry with me when I was angry with him. He would look up to me and respect me. He would be eager to learn. He would stand next to me in prayer, even if he was too young to understand. He would sense the respect required. He would be mine, as you were your mother's. It was a Wednesday. Hadia and Huda were at school. Your mother was at home with you. Movement toward the awareness of a loss is a strange thing. I do not understand how time seems to slow just before and days after it has become a reality. How fragments imprint themselves into memory, sharp and vivid. It was as though the phone rang on my desk, and I knew it was going to be Layla as I reached for it. And before she had even begun speaking, I knew why she had called. And as she spoke, something solid lodged in the center of my throat that did not dissolve until hours afterward.
"Something's happened," she said in Urdu. "I need you."
She sounded disoriented.
"Don't be afraid," I said. "I am coming."
I hung up the office phone. I thanked God I was in town. "Stand up," I told myself. "Grab keys, coat, container of leftover lunch. Tell my boss. Call someone to pick up the girls from school." But instead, I leaned back into the soft cushion of the office chair and folded my hands in my lap. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. On my desk was an old desktop computer that hummed. A clear square container held paper clips. A tape dispenser. A small calendar I had forgotten to change to the correct month. On the gray walls that formed my cubicle, I had tacked a letter from Hadia, a poem from Huda composed of the first letters of my name. Right, awesome, father, interesting, quiet. And a watercolor you painted that your mother, and not you, had given me. It was of a red boat on a blue river. I was impressed by how you knew to use different shades of blue to indicate waves, evoke movement. And there was a photograph of the three of you. You, a baby in Huda's arms, Hadia with her hand resting formally on Huda's shoulder. This is it, I thought. Then, focusing on the small face that was yours, half obscured by the blanket you were wrapped in. You were it. There would be no second son. I did not know what to say or do to comfort your mother. I waited for her to address me or ask something of me. Ask me for water, I thought. Ask me to bring you takeout from the restaurant we like. But she said nothing. I drove you three to the Ali family's house, where you would stay until I brought you back on the weekend, when I would be home to help Layla. I could not take my hands off the steering wheel, not even for a second, and my thoughts tugged me to terrible places as I drove. Now that we had suffered one loss, I wondered when the next would come for us. "Are you all comfortable?" I asked Hadia when I visited the three of you as soon as I was off of work.
"They're very nice to us," Hadia said.
Then, looking down at her shirt and playing with the edge of her sleeve,
"Is it because they know what's wrong?"
"Nothing is wrong." She looked at me. She was too smart for me. I was, as my co-workers like to say, in over my head. I touched her forehead and told her to go play.
"But remember," I pointed a finger at her. She looked back at the Yalli sons playing in the garden, all three of them children, the eldest no more than 7.
Just acquaintances,
she giggled. Back then, she had a funny way of pronouncing it, the syllables jamming together at the end. Good girl, I said, and I smiled at her. Sister Seema told me that you either clung to Hadia or, if she was busy, chose to stay inside with her and Amara. I walked into the living room, and there you were, seated on top of a sofa facing a window. You turned to acknowledge my presence before looking back outside. The look in your eyes frightened me. You were so little, but I wondered if you blamed me for your mother's absence.
Where's Mama?
You asked. I sat down on the couch. I waited for you to turn to me. She's not here, I said.
Can you take me to where Mama is?
I wanted to give you everything you wanted. Tomorrow, I said softly. You nodded. You had nothing else to ask me. Once again, I felt like I did not know how to interact with you. I wonder now what we could have been had I had the courage to lift you into my arms as I wanted to then, tell you that tomorrow you would see your mother, but that today I was here for you, that you had lost a brother and I a son, that I had you, and you would never lose me. But instead, I stood up from the couch, I thanked Sister Seema for her kindness, and drove the dark roads back to our house, where your mother had still not turned on the lights. I parked in the driveway and sat there until the car cooled, until I composed myself, before stepping inside and being brave enough for your mother. And here we are. I am startled awake. A dim light comes from the hall beneath the curtain that wraps around my bed. The medicine they give me here makes my mind fuzzy. My memories come to me sharply, or not at all. I have woken uneasy. Am I afraid? The room is silent in answer. The TV is turned off all throughout the hall. The rectangular window, a sheet of black. The flowers, blue in their vases. We love you, Nana, faces me in gray text. My life has taken on a look I do not recognize as immediately mine. I am not dizzy, and so I step from my bed. My legs are chilly. I slip my feet into socks, then slippers, grab my sweater. What a decision you made over a decade ago when you first ran away. Even now, during the last stretch of my life, I cannot fathom walking willfully away. The nurses on duty are in the center of the floor. They sit behind desks and computer screens, and I can hear them chatting. If I walk along the wall to the staircase to my right, I can be out unseen, and soon the door echoes shut behind me. My head does not hurt tonight. My legs move without telling me they are tired. I will step down the flight of stairs until it takes me to floor 1, where I will exit out into the parking lot. If I do not count the events of the past week, I would say I am in fairly good health. I have outlived both of my parents by decades. I thought I was just prone to headaches. I thought the weakness of my arms and legs was a symptom of aging. The railing is cold as I step down toward the bottom of the stairwell. I stop in my tracks as a nurse turns the corner, and her eyes widen from surprise at the sight of me.
What are you doing?
She asks. Her voice echoes. She glances at my gown peeking from my sweater, and my silver bracelet on my wrist.
It's 5 a.m.
My surgery is tomorrow. I do not know why I say it. She does not work on my floor. I have never seen her before. I can see her trying to figure out if I am dangerous or if I am delusional, a danger to myself.
Sir, you can't leave your room. Can you tell me what your room number is?
Every day of my life, I've taken a walk outside. I have been in here for a week. I haven't seen the sky in days. I wanted to see it before. It is clear that the woman does not know what to do. I feel bad for startling her, for asking her to break code. I am on the fourth floor, I tell her. Room 405. I turn around and begin climbing the stairs. She steps next to me at my pace. She is quiet. One floor up, she whispers,
"Will a balcony do?"
She holds a finger to her lips and shushes. I follow her. I feel a dizziness I take for excitement. She unlocks a door and tells me it is a break room where no one will be at this hour. A couch, a coffee table, a kitchenette, and a sliding glass door. I thank her. I ask her name. "Ida," she says, opening the sliding door. I step out into the cold.
"We can't stay long," she says.
She looks around nervously. She stands a little behind me. No clouds, but some wisps. A clear night. A few stars. The best we can do when we are so close to the city. I think, God, if this is my last time looking at the night sky, I thank you for having given me so many nights like this one.
I cannot help it.
I blink rapidly, not wanting to make her any more uncomfortable. When my children were very little, if I did not know how to make them stop crying or make them happy, I would take them outside, show them this.
"Oh," she says softly, "that is very nice. I am sure they will remember that."
I shrug.
I hoped so.
My daughters were quick to feel better. They would begin talking to me instead, or would ask to walk around. But my son, he would look for a long time, until we had to go back. No need for talking. The wisps of clouds are making their way across the far sky. Ida waits until it is appropriate to take me back. Hadia said there were no guarantees. I am not ready. There are things I need you to know. I stare at the white glow of the moon until something in me calms. "Do you really think they will remember it?" I ask. My voice feels as weak as my hands, and I hold them together behind my back to keep from feeling it. She reaches out to rest her hand on my arm. I do not pull away. I think of how kind strangers are to me, and how maybe I have not been kind enough to other strangers to deserve it. I think of Dawn, when you were sleeping in your clear crib in the hospital, and how generously she reassured me you would be all right. Years later, I wander down a different hospital hallway with a different cause for the heaviness of my heart, and it is as though we live until we become other people entirely, keeping only that same need for hope, for comfort. And how miraculous it is to me that we receive in this world the very things we need from it. How tonight it is another stranger who has stepped forward to play that same part. Help me get through this night until morning.
It's a part of them.
Ida says, drawing her hand away.